tell you, the day that I realized I hadn't understood it at all was in Guamaca, Honduras, which is very much more like ancient Jerusalem than we are used to. A lot of little houses packed into a small area, and most of them have some chickens. And everybody who has chickens has roosters.
You'll want to be sure to catch the rest of Pastor Terry's message in just a moment. But first, we want to thank you for tuning in to the Indian Run Christian Church broadcast with pastor and author Terry Bailey. This broadcast is also produced as a free podcast, which you can find on iTunes or become a subscriber through our website. We'll have more information at the end of the broadcast, but for right now, let's join Pastor Terry as he preaches this insightful message.
Very dangerous time to be a Christian. Torture, beheadings, destruction.
The highest level of persecution of Christians.
A church congregation barricaded themselves in from hundreds of riot police.
They're enduring attacks for their faith like
along
never
with the
before.
Savage kidnappings of Christian schoolgirls in Nigeria by Boko Haram and the burning of
Christian
images
churches.
Of violence dominate headlines.
Christians are being warned they have a choice. Convert to Islam, pay a very steep price, or face death.
Chilling new video showing the beheading of 21 Egyptian Christians.
Beheadings of 21 Christians.
21 Christian men beheaded by Islamic State.
The title of the video is a message signed with blood to the nation of the cross.
We have seen the sharpest jump in violent attacks against Christians. We need to make the persecuted church an issue of prayer.
As we prepare ourselves to celebrate Easter, it would pay us to take account of the persecution of Christians in the modern world. We had probably better begin to come to grips with the concept, because the persecution of Christians is as old as Christianity itself and will continue until Christ returns to make all things new. I will add to that, in the words of King Solomon, there is nothing new under the sun. The persecution of Christians today has a definite political face. It has a high violence factor. And it also has a sexual aspect. Many Christian women are sold into slavery. It is awful, but it is not new. In the course of the great Roman persecutions, there arose a practice among high-ranking military officers that they would have Christian wives. These wives generally acquired by force. Women sorted out from crowds, destined for execution or for the arena, and just kept. The officer in question would usually keep the Christian religion of his new wife secret for obvious reasons. The Roman officers adopted this practice because as they persecuted the Christians, they had the opportunity to see these people's character under extreme stress. And there was much that was to be admired, and they especially admired the Christian women compared to the pagan Roman women they were acquainted with. Officers had to be gone often and for long periods of time, and a righteous, trustworthy woman was much to be desired. So they just took them. Obviously, this was another despicable element of the larger persecution, and yet we know the promise of God, who says, "I work all things together for good to those who love me and are called according to my purpose." One such Christian woman, Helena, was taken to wife by one such Roman officer, Chloris Constantine, and those two had a child, Constantine the Great. Now, I should be clear, they did not name that little baby Constantine the Great. Just in case you were wondering, how would that be to start your life out with that sort of expectation? You know, it would be like Kyle the Great. How are you going to live up to that one, Kyle? And then, of course, you know, your brother would probably be like Bruce the Just Average. And the whole family dynamic would be shot before you ever got a chance. In Constantine's term, the Great was added as a matter of historical perspective. On the day of his birth, February 27th, AD 272, they named him Flavius Valerius Aurelius Constantinus. He would grow up to be a military man like his father. And he would grow up to be a Christian like his mother. We cannot know this side of the grave, how great the influence that Helena had on her son, but I, for one, cannot believe that her religion was simply incidental. The Roman Empire was split administratively in those days, east and west, and Constantine worked his way up until he became the administrative leader of the eastern half. At the death of the overall emperor, Rome broke into civil war, and Constantine took it upon himself this task of busting enough heads, pulling enough rival factors in to reunify the broken empire. Right before a key battle that led to the settling and reunification of the empire, Constantine said he had a vision in which he saw the sign of the cross projected upward from the sun, and with the cross the words, "In this symbol, conquer." And he had his soldiers draw the image of the cross on their shields. And he had them march through a local river for mass baptism. But he had them march through the river with one arm up holding their swords so that that didn't get wet. He wanted his soldiers to be Christians, but he wanted their sword arms to be Roman. I guess among all the things that Romans admired about Christian swordsmanship did not make the list. But Constantine won that crucial battle, reunited the empire, of which he was now the emperor, and in the big victory celebration, he pointedly ignored the altars to the pagan Roman gods that were always set up for either the return of a victorious general or the installation of a new emperor, both of which were appropriate to him, and he just kind of walked by them and snubbed them, those altars to the pagan gods. First emperor or returning hero ever to do so. Later that year, AD 312, he issued the Edict of Milan, officially putting an end to the Roman persecution of Christians. And just a few years after that, he assembled the Council of Nicaea, which is generally understood to be the birth of the Roman Catholic Church. Now, file all that away for a moment. As we march toward Easter, we find Jesus and the apostles assembled in the upper room. They had observed the Passover feast. Last week, as we saw, Jesus promised unto his disciples to give them a kingdom, the upside-down kingdom. And now we find him saying some additional things that the apostles found at least as confusing as the upside-down kingdom. And I'll apologize in advance. It seems to me that my sermon is a little disconnected this week, but there are so many things in this little passage that we don't have a complete and proper understanding of, and I'll try to rectify that. It's just that there's a lot of them. Last week we were upside down. This week we'll be backwards. Because I find that the easiest way for me to do this is to kind of start at the end of the passage and work my way back up toward the top. Jesus said to his apostles, "Go get yourself some swords." You remember? Remember he said how when I sent you out before on your big preaching tour, I told you don't take any money with you, don't take any food with you, don't take a bag with you to carry extra money or food if you happen to come across any. Don't take anything, don't even take spare sandals for your feet, just take the clothes on your back and go. Remember? They remembered. So remember how when you did that, you never went hungry and you never froze? They remembered. The people that they preached to took them in and fed them and sheltered them and took care of them and blessed them and sent them on their way. It helped that at this point in the ministry of the apostles, Jesus gave unto them the power and authority to work miracles, and they were healing diseases and casting out demons, and they made a lot of friends doing that. They remembered. And Jesus says, yeah, remember that because those days are over. It's time to get your hands on some walking around money. And some extra provisions. And prepare to put more water in the soup. And if you don't have a sword, sell some of those clothes on your back so you can go out and buy one. The sell your cloak to buy a sword thing was actually a pretty well-known proverb at the time. Your cloak kept you warm. Your sword might keep you alive. Better the wisdom run to stay alive long enough to shiver the next night. Come to that. On the very surface of it, Jesus seems to be saying, the next time you go out without me is not going to be at all like the last time you went out without me. They're not going to welcome you in and give you a place to sleep and feed you this time. Or if they do, the place they give you to sleep will be jail. And they're not going to figure on feeding you for long. You're going to be one step ahead of the hangman running for your life. So carry some hotel money and a couple of sandwiches and a sword. If you can get it. Well, see, some people would say that Constantine was the first Christian to get it right. The cross painted on your shield, a sword in your hand, the imperial treasury at your call. That's what Christianity needs so it can meet the world on its own terms and whack some people once in a while when they need it. Saint Augustine, who lived and ministered in the peace and prosperity of the Christian empire that Constantine created, would have agreed. I am somewhat less certain. At least, I am certain that's not what Jesus meant on this occasion. Peter responded to his words saying, well, we have two swords, see? And Jesus said, that'll do. Two is enough. I don't think he meant that two swords would be sufficient to overturn the world militarily. Nor did he mean even that two swords would be sufficient to fend off the people who were going to arrest him that very night and crucify him the following day. He did not mean to prevent the crucifixion at all. As it turns out, he did explain what he meant. He said, you need to get some swords because it had been prophesied about me that I would be numbered with transgressors, and the prophecy must be fulfilled. So you guys got to do some transgressing. So go out and get a sword. Michael was making a face at me. The on the face of it interpretation is still there. The next time the apostles go out preaching, they will be hunted criminals. In terms of the prophecy of Jesus being associated with lawbreakers, for the moment, two swords will be more than sufficient to transform the apostles into lawbreakers. According to Roman law, they shouldn't have any swords. The fact that they have two, much less intend to use them, makes them lawbreakers. And later, when Peter would use one of those swords to cut the ear off of the high priest's servant, Jesus would demonstrate plainly enough that he did not mean to mount an armed defense. He said, if my kingdom were of this world, that might make sense. But it isn't. And he picked up the severed ear and put it back on Malchus's maimed head and healed him. And he said to Peter, "He who lives by the sword dies by the sword." Interesting thing here. Some of the apostles would die by the sword anyway. And even if it wasn't a literal sword in the end, which it was for some of them, most of them would die violently. What we have here is another proverb of the day: live by the sword, die by the sword. We still quote it, but we have lost something of the meaning that it held for Jesus or anybody else quoting it at that time. He did not mean that if you used a sword, you were inevitably doomed to be run through by a sword. What he meant was, there are different brands of justice. Just to pick two to illustrate the case, there is justice at the point of the sword, and there is justice by the hand of the Lord. And sometimes we have to pick between the two. And whichever brand of justice we choose, the point of the sword or the hand of the Lord, whichever we choose, we have to trust everything to it. We have to live by it. We have to die by it. The import of these words to the apostles were, don't rely on justice at the point of the sword. Rely on justice by the hand of the Lord. Live and die by that. I think they got it. They encountered much violence in the years to come, and we have no record of any testimony of the apostles ever defending themselves or the church they watched over with swords. They put all that in the hands of God. Back to the main point, we have plenty of testimony of the apostles and other Christians being considered lawbreakers. In fact, it seemed to be crucial that the church be born into the world as a counter-cultural force. But the armed defense of the church by the church, armed with weapons of the day, was born and died on the night that Jesus was arrested. The sword in defense of the church. Well, God would use Constantine and the state that he led to give the church breathing room for a century or so in which to accomplish the ministry of the day. Both Paul and Peter agreed that God grants unto the state the right of the sword. And God uses states all the time. He used the state of Rome and the ebb and flow of persecution and protection, because both things, persecution of the church here, protection of the church there, persecution now, protection then, both things ultimately accomplish the purposes of God. But the state is one thing, and the ministry of the church is something else. In terms of my continuing private study this year, the ministry of the state and the ministry of the church come together in one bigger thing called, can you guess? The kingdom. The realm where the will of God is done. But the relationship of the church and the state and the kingdom is not really the matter at hand, so I will leave that tiny scratch on the surface of that subject and go back to this. The Apostle Peter and his associates did not have time for philosophical and political study anyway. Things were happening fast. Another step backward in the text. Jesus allowed. Everything was about to get hairy. Peter said, well, it doesn't matter. Let it get hairy. If they arrest you, they're going to have to arrest me. If they kill you, they're going to have to kill me. Whatever happens to you isn't going to happen to you alone. They're going to have to take me with you. I am in, come what may. And Jesus said, sure, except that before the cock crows, you're going to deny me three times in an effort to save your own skin. About that cock crowing thing, we don't really understand that one either. When Jesus said before the cock crows, he was not talking about some one divinely appointed rooster who would go down in history with Balaam's donkey or the infamous red heifer. In our modern world of cities and suburbs and alarm clocks, we have kind of lost track of this phenomenon. I grew up on a little farm. We kept chickens. We had roosters. I thought I understood this. I tell you, The day that I realized I hadn't understood it at all was in Guamaca, Honduras, which is very much more like ancient Jerusalem than we are used to. A lot of little houses packed into a small area, and most of them have some chickens. And everybody who has chickens has a rooster. And somewhere along about midnight, one of those roosters stirs in his sleep, and he crows. And the rooster next door, which may be no further away from me than Norma, thinks, "Holy smokes, I should be crowing." And he crows. And the next thing you know, all 10,000 roosters that live in that square mile are crowing. And it's a bedlam. And it happens again about dawn. And there's no missing it. The timing of Peter's denial of Christ coincided with the time at which the first crow was set off and all the others followed. So if we get this right this time, it went something like this. "I tell you, I don't know him." Talk about highlighting your moment of failure. And Peter would hear that sound most every day for the rest of his life. And I bet he never heard it without being carried back in his mind to the lowest moment of his life when he denied Lord Jesus. Now let's back up another step. Jesus said to Peter, "Simon, Simon, Satan has demanded permission to sift you like wheat." Here's another bit of the biblical worldview that we do not generally understand. We know that Satan has fallen from heaven. We are generally a little bit confused on when exactly that happened. I'm going to give you the shortest possible version. If it seems odd to you and you want to talk about this in more detail, you come and see me. Satan fell from heaven the moment Jesus was resurrected from the dead. Until then, until the resurrection of Jesus Christ, Satan still had access to the throne of God and stood there as the accuser of men, just as he did in the days of Job or in the days of Zechariah and Joshua the high priest, saying, "That man is worthless. Let me show you." And that woman over there, she's worse than worthless. "Let me show you. They are all together become filthy. Let me just demonstrate this for you." And when Jesus speaks of Satan's attempt to show our lack of value, he uses the metaphor of sifting wheat. Satan pours the life of a man or a woman before the wind of events and circumstances. And that wind should blow away the chaff and let the good heavy grain fall through to be collected. And it's good circumstances and bad circumstances. Let me assure you about this. Comfort and prosperity can be just as spiritually damaging to us as poverty and hardship. But Satan's bet is that when he has poured our lives before the wind of circumstances, everything will be blown away and nothing good will remain to fall down into the keeping pile, because there was nothing good about us to start with. When he has finished sifting us, he predicts, we will blow away as chaff entirely and nothing will remain. Peter is about to pass through the sifting process, and Satan intends to demonstrate that there is no courage, no loyalty, no nobility, nothing good in this man. And if you take only that moment at which the crowing of the cock marked Peter's signal failure, you might be tempted to agree. But Jesus says, "I've prayed for you, Peter. I've prayed for you." and you're going to fail. But you're going to come back. And when you come back as one who knows what it is to fail and to be redeemed in return, it will be your job to strengthen your brothers. Here is the difference between Satan thinking and God thinking. Satan knows that Peter will fail and says, "See, I told you he was worthless." God also knows that Peter will fail and devises a plan in which he will give everything to help clean the man up and stand him back on his feet and make him better. So that the epic fail in the end belongs to Satan. We are closing in on Easter. For the apostles, this season was a dark and scary time marked by great human failure and haunting questions about the church and the kingdom and who was going to protect them, how they were to be defended. We live in increasingly dark and scary times and become more and more confronted with the same questions. Not a day goes by now, but that Christians somewhere will be asked to set Christ aside to save their skin. I'm just asking, if it was us in that video, would our faith just blow away like chaff? Would something remain to fall through into the keeper pile? I can tell you that plenty of people closer to home set Christ aside only to save their reputation or a little inconvenience. And there is the remaining temptation of picking up the sword, trying to answer the world on its own terms. And there is just the plain old-fashioned carnal temptation, wealth, fame, the lust of the flesh. And we fail. In so many ways, we fail. By so many measures, we fail. Can you hear those roosters? I can. I hear them because I am more than comfortably familiar with my record of personal failure. But I hear another sound, too. We're still a few weeks out, but I hear it already, the grating rumble of a big rock being rolled away. And when I hear that sound, I know my failures are about to be redeemed.
We want to take a moment to thank all of you, our listeners, for setting aside time each week for the Indian Run Christian Church broadcast on this station. You can find out more about the church with a quick visit to our website at www.christforeastcanton.com. On behalf of Pastor Terry and all the folks at Indian Run Christian Church, I pray God's blessing on you and your family.